Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Coming up, challenging the notion that young people don't vote. Will this presidential election get the internet generation to the polls?
We have people coming in every day that say, you know, what can I do to help this campaign? I'll clean the floors, I'll, you know, bring in cookies, I'll make calls, I'll do anything I can. And it's this movement. It's different than a campaign. It's a movement.
Also, is California's laid-back surf culture wiping out on a sea of corporate cash? And why growers on rich farmland are at each other's throats?
The worst thing that's happening in this valley right now is you have farmers fighting farmers. And then the outside world looks at us and says, look at those dummies. Instead of sticking together, we're beating each other up.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. They're calling it Super Duper Tuesday or Tsunami Tuesday, February 5th, the day California and 23 other states cast their votes for president. It's a day many think will determine the Republican and Democratic nominees. And with the races in both parties very much undecided, the candidates are hoping to motivate new voters, especially those between the ages of 18 and 29, trying to mobilize them to do something many have never done, vote.
Today, who are we voting for? Barack? Yeah, yeah! Barack Obama, you better know!
A reggae singer on the steps of San Francisco City Hall is the warm-up act for supporters of Barack Obama. They've gathered just after the New Hampshire primary, where the Illinois Democrat finished a close second to Hillary Clinton.
Now we head into the next few weeks preparing for our chance as Californians to prove how much we believe in Barack Obama's candidacy. Barack!
Obama!
Yes, we are Californians.
One of the speakers is Julie Lithcott-Hames, Stanford University's Dean of Freshman Students and an active Obama supporter. She tells the crowd her candidate is breaking through to the internet generation.
I have watched in admiration for them as Barack has inspired them to put down their Nintendo Wiis and their instant messaging and their iPods and start talking about the future of this country and the issues that matter deeply to them.
Younger voters were key to Obama's victory in Iowa. At the opening of his campaign headquarters in Palo Alto last weekend, there were plenty of students on hand from nearby Stanford. The campaign is identifying precinct captains in campus dormitories. Stanford senior Alfred Johnson, a field organizer for Obama, is impressed by what he's seeing.
We have people coming in every day that say, you know, what can I do to help this campaign? I'll clean the floors, I'll, you know, bring in cookies, I'll make calls, I'll do anything I can. And it's this movement. It's different than a campaign. It's a movement, and it's an exciting thing to be a part of.
Obama is by no means the only candidate reaching out to younger voters. All the leading candidates have profiles on social networking sites MySpace and Facebook. Even John McCain, the oldest candidate in the race, makes regular appearances on TV shows like The Daily Show. And he participated in a cyber town hall event sponsored by the music channel MTV.
Senator McCain, I wanted to follow up. As I mentioned, I'm taking instant messages, and we've got one here from M. Strand, 1980. Mr. McCain, as president, what would warrant an attack on another country in the Middle East, for instance, Syria or Iran, if either one became nuclear? Can you talk about how you specifically would make decisions as it relates to these countries like Iran and Syria?
In the case of both of those countries, it depends on whether they pose an immediate threat to the security of the United States of America and our interests there.
Despite his age, or maybe because of it, McCain appeals to younger voters who seem to like his candor and sense of humor.
My friends, I'm not the youngest candidate in this race. You know that. But I am the most experienced. I'm older than Frankenstein. I got a few scars and I'm older than dirt.
This year, the internet is the backbone of every campaign operation. It's being used for fundraising, of course, but in an effort to reach younger Americans where they live, there are also candidate blogs, YouTube videos, and links to voter registration on candidate websites. Those sites generate thousands of hits and lots of chat room buzz, but just how engaged is the typical student? We visited City College in San Francisco to try and find out. Students are just getting back to school this week after their winter break. Outside the campus bookstore, students were milling about, catching up with friends, and hauling off books for the new semester. I ask 18-year-old Calvin Wong if he's paying attention to the presidential campaign.
Not at all. I mean, my parents play the news at night during dinner, but that's about it.
So you're not planning to vote?
I'm registered to vote, so I'm just going to vote when my parents vote.
And do you talk about it at home?
Not at all.
Wong says he doesn't know who his parents are supporting, but when pressed, Wong says he'd probably vote for Barack Obama. Calvin Wong isn't alone in saying the campaign hasn't exactly captivated him. Alex Coffin is a 25-year-old engineering student who says he's disappointed by the candidates so far.
They don't actually say anything real. They have a bunch of sound bites that they try and get out every time they speak. But they don't actually say anything or actually say how they're going to do any of these things.
Coffin wants to know how we're going to pay for all these programs the candidates are promising, like universal health care. Adrena Winfield has an armful of cookbooks and an easy smile. The 20-year-old culinary student is voting for Hillary Clinton. She thinks it's important for young people to participate in this election, but what about her friends?
How much do you think people your age, students, are thinking about the election?
I would say students more that are in the school environment will probably be more focused on the election or working or who are into politics. But a lot of kids my age, I'm saying kids because I'm still young, I don't think they're really into voting.
Why?
Because they really don't care much about it. They don't see how much it affects them and the consequences of their voting. They don't think that their vote counts very much.
Here in California, people under the age of 29 make up 17% of the registered voters. But in his San Francisco office, field poll director Mark DiCamillo says history suggests that candidates counting on young voters to win an election are often disappointed.
Younger voters are by far the least likely group to turn out in elections. In fact, there's a straight line correlation. The older you are, the more likely you are to vote in just about every election that I've seen.
Older voters, he says, are far more likely to care about issues like bond measures or complicated policy questions.
Younger voters are less tied to, a residence. They're still in transition, many of them, in terms of jobs. A lot of the issues that are being discussed in politics just don't affect their daily lives in a more direct way.
Still, DiCamillo says this election could be different. The closeness of the race and the historic nature of the candidates might just inspire and motivate enough of the internet generation to log off long enough to vote. California and surfing go way back, and now the latest wave in surfing, riding giant waves, has also become a California thing. That was clear with the swell of interest in Mavericks last weekend, the world's biggest big wave contest. In tiny Half Moon Bay, more than 40,000 people turned out to see regular-sized surfers dwarfed by 35-foot waves. All that public interest has generated big-name sponsors, big prize money, and lots of product placement. For the rebel sport with the laid-back loner attitude, that brings up one very dirty and unmentionable question. Has surfing gone corporate? David Gorn reports.
The Maverick Surf Contest gathers the best big wave surfers from all over the world, and they better be good. When they get on top of a Maverick-sized wave, it's like looking straight down from a three-story apartment building. So what draws a man to fly halfway around the world, paddle through the ice-cold, shark-infested ocean, and stand on a small piece of fiberglass pursued by a 3-ton wall of water? Well, must be good money.
Oh, man.
Yes, the first place prize at Mavericks is $30,000. And surfing has become big business, a $7 billion a year industry nationwide. How does that square with the image surfers cultivate of a devil-may-care seat-of-the-pants culture where no one really cares about money? San Francisco resident and Mavericks finalist Grant Washburn can tell you.
It's weird. It's a weird thing. We don't have a lot of money. None of these guys make much money doing this, which is another thing that people are like, oh, you know, the fame and the fortune. Well, the fortune is, you know, you could work at McDonald's and make more of a fortune. Like, my sister's a principal. She makes more money than you know, any of these guys.
The money in the surfing industry is in the surf culture, Washburn says. Surfboards and wetsuits don't rake in much cash. Most of that $7 billion is in clothing manufacturing. That is, the cash comes from people who have never surfed, but who like those way cool Billabong sweatshirts or Abercrombie surfer t-shirts. Everyone wants to look like a surfer because surfers are cool. And the money from any of that, Washburn says, surfers never see.
We just love it. You know, people think ego and money and that kind of stuff. I mean, the obvious motives for sort of any other sport. And they're just less at play out here because you're actually going to drown or die.
Yeah, but what about all that prize money? 30 grand? That's a lot of cash for a day's work.
It's almost like the $30,000 was just a little weight on the shoulders that, you know, didn't need to be out there.
You wouldn't normally think of $30,000 as a burden, but Greg Long of Orange County, the first place winner at Mavericks, swears it was. Well, a little.
Yeah, even though it's never about the money, there is that carrot there, you know, at the end, and it'll be in the back of your mind. It's not the way, you know, we wanted to surf our big wave contest.
How Greg Long and the other five finalists decided to surf the biggest contest of the year is that they agreed to share all the prize money evenly. See, the ocean was at a lull. The six final riders drifted their boards together and made a pact. All for one, one for all. The prize money from the top six spots split into six shares. Hard to imagine the Green Bay Packers getting together with the New England Patriots and sharing Super Bowl winnings. Deciding it didn't matter who won, that they were doing it for the sport of it. Of course, says Grant Washburn, life looks different from the middle of the ocean.
Just like, this is gut feeling how we should play it, and everybody got off on it, and after we shook hands, you could see, like, everybody's just so happy. Like, you know, we hadn't gotten any waves yet. We made the final. We shook hands. No more money thing. Whoever wins has to tell everybody on the podium, okay, here comes the waves. Boom! They go, guys just charging it, you know? Everyone got a good one, and man, you know, it couldn't get any better. I'm still buzzed from it.
And so it looks like the cool aura around surfers is going to survive, uncorporatized. For the sweatshirt manufacturers to use at their pleasure. For the California Report, I'm David Gord.
On a splinter of land in southeastern California, about 400 farmers irrigate their fields with water from the Colorado River just before it crosses the border into Mexico. They use more than a fifth of the river's entire watershed, as much as Utah, Wyoming, and Nevada combined. It's been this way since 1922, when the Imperial Valley was given preferential rights to the river. But times are changing. As global warming begins to shrink the amount of water in the Colorado, fast-growing urban areas are eyeing the Imperial Valley as their next watering hole. LA Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports on the coming water war.
The best way to get a lay of the land in the Imperial Valley is to leave the land.
Imperial traffic, Bonanza 5360, Echo taking off runway 32 straight out, departure northbound.
Farmer Ralph Strom takes me up in his 1959 Beechcraft two-seater. Within a few minutes, we're 1,000 feet above the valley. Up here, you're reminded of the transformative power of water.
It's really amazing how the fact that this is a desert, and then right here, it's just so lush, it's just green.
Yeah, we don't get enough rainfall for any kind of agriculture.
From high above, the Imperial Valley looks like a dark emerald someone dropped on the beach. Beyond, there's nothing but golden desert. This gem of a valley looks out of place, unnatural, and it is. An incredible feat of human engineering made it this way. 155 years ago, a geologist noticed this valley, only 50 miles west of the Colorado River, was below sea level. He noticed something else. The soil here was very fertile. Today, 3,000 miles of canals and drainage ditches crisscross the half-million-acre valley. It's the most extensive irrigation system in the world, and it's made this valley a farmer's dream come true. Complete control over cheap water in a place where the sun shines almost every day. Many farmers here are millionaires as a result. They're able to grow practically whatever they want, whenever they want. From his pilot seat, Ralph Strom points out the patchwork quilt of crops.
The darker green fields are alfalfa. Light green fields are probably Bermuda grass.
Other shades of green represent lettuce, wheat, sugarcane. But in the last year, patches of brown have appeared here and there. Back on the ground, I walk through stalks of dead wheat. They look like toothpicks piercing the cracked, parched soil. With all the water this valley receives, why are some farmers allowing their fields to dry up? Because urban areas on the coast are paying them good money to do it, so they, the cities, can use the water instead. water in this valley has become a commodity. A program to leave fields fallow is part of a deal the Imperial Irrigation District made 5 years ago. The district, which goes by the acronym IID, holds the valley's water right in trust on behalf of the farmers. In 2003, the IID agreed to sell 10% of the valley's water to San Diego. It was the largest water transfer in U.S. history, and it has divided what was once a united valley of farmers.
It's not like they've gone out to be corrupt. The nature of the beast is just corrupt.
Farmer Mike Morgan is grumbling about local water managers as he maneuvers his Dodge truck between fields of vegetables. He wears sunglasses. A ponytail of graying blonde hair sprouts from behind his cowboy hat. His land borders the southern shore of the Salton Sea, an enormous salt lake. The sound of him stopping his truck and opening his door startles thousands of white pelicans. They take flight in unison. For a moment, the blue sky is flooded white. Morgan's too angry to notice. We've been talking about the water transfer, and it's riled him up.
Most bureaucracies misspend your tax money. This one's misspending the whole lifeblood of the whole valley.
Farmers pay the IID $17 for an acre foot of water. As part of the water transfer, the IID is selling the same water for around $300 an acre foot to San Diego, ultimately reaping several $1 billion for local conservation projects. But Morgan thinks the IID is selling the water too cheaply. He's led a group of farmers to file suit to stop the water transfer. He wants individual farmers, not the IID, to control the historic water rights of the valley. Not a good idea, says Jean-Pierre Menville.
The worst thing that's happening in this valley right now is you have farmers fighting farmers.
Menville is one of those farmers. He's the vice president of the IID Board of Directors. He says if Morgan and his group had their way, farmers would be able to sell their share of water to the highest bidder, destroying the valley's economy. Menville says the infighting among farmers over who owns this precious resource is a vulnerability that the valley's thirsty urban neighbors could exploit.
That's a bad deal. And then the outside world looks at us and says, look at those dummies. Instead of sticking together, we're beating each other up, which is ludicrous.
The water transfer was wildly unpopular with all farmers here. In fact, soon after the deal was signed, the IID board passed a resolution saying the agency would never transfer its water again. But many farmers here quietly fear the resolution is toothless and that the last water transfer may provide a blueprint for future ones, turning this region into a kind of water ATM. That may sound far-fetched, but the truth is every drop of water in the Colorado River is allocated to users in 7 states. And scientists predict by mid-century, climate change will reduce the water in the river by 15%. That's a conservative estimate. In that scenario, someone's going to have to give up water. And urban water agencies know full well this desert valley, population a mere 150,000, has rights to 1/5 of the entire Colorado.
It's a shocking number, and while the aggregate value of the crops grown in Imperial Valley is substantial, relative to other uses of that quantity of water, it's pretty pathetic.
Robert Glennon is a professor of law at the University of Arizona.
If you were to examine the state of Nevada with its water use for the Las Vegas Strip, you would find that they use 1/10 the amount of water of the Imperial Valley, but they generate a huge multiple in terms of jobs and revenues to the community for the use of that water.
But people still need to eat, and that's where the Imperial Valley comes in, argue folks like Andy Horn, a former IID board member. If you eat salad in the winter, it's a good bet most of its vegetables are grown in the valley. The warm temperatures here make the valley an essential supplier of fresh produce in the winter. Whether it's from rapid urban development or a drier climate, Horn says if the time comes for another water transfer from this region, it'll force society to face the consequences of drying up an important agricultural resource.
People are really going to have to do some soul searching as to whether or not they think it's a good idea to quit farming and grow yards for people in suburbia and build strip malls, whether or not that's a better use of water than using it to grow food for people. And I think that's the ultimate choice our society is going to have to make.
That's a choice some here believe has already been made. For the California Report, I'm Rob Schmitz in the Imperial Valley.
For years, many of California's Chinatowns have been rumored to be riddled with secret tunnels. The rumors were disproved in Los Angeles and Sacramento, but in the city of Fresno, archaeologists are investigating whether there may be some truth to those tales. They found interconnecting basements under some downtown shops, leaving the city wondering about the possibility of an underground Chinatown and delving into its colorful history.
My father was born there in 1913 in my grandfather's pool hall between a bar and a house of ill repute.
Kathy Omachi is spearheading the effort to restore Chinatown and its history. A secret world of drinking, gambling, and prostitution is now being explored above and below its surface. Omachi has heard a lot about this hidden world from stories about her grandfather, who emigrated from Japan.
He came as a young man, about 1900, so he did spend a lot of time probably frequenting the above services and below services. He used to bet against himself in sumo ring wrestling because he always knew he would lose.
Fresno's Chinatown looks somewhat abandoned today. Most of the buildings are made of old brick and faded handmade signs hang in the windows. But years ago, it was a bustling neighborhood, a real melting pot of cultures.
You could end up having your wash done at a French laundry. You could have donuts at a Chinese donut shop. You could go for great Mexican food. You could go to the Greek theater for some live entertainment. It was really jam-packed with people and activities.
Omachi greets the owner of a local barber shop. She walks toward a door on one side of the room. In the waiting area, a small bench blocks the door to the basement. A woman and her young son, waiting for a haircut, politely give up their seats so it can be moved. Omachi leads the way to the back of the basement with only a tiny flashlight in hand. A maze of low-hanging pipes makes it even more difficult to navigate in the dark.
You have to watch your head, too, so that you don't conk yourself.
Brick archways line the surrounding walls, but mysteriously, the archways are sealed with bricks. Carefully walking through an opening in the wall, Omachi shines the light on a very unusual door.
You could see that it's nail-studded, it's very old, and it's reinforced, and it has something very interesting right there. That's one of the first times we've seen a door that has a peephole.
Looking through this peephole 100 years ago might have revealed an underground brothel. The tiny rooms called cribs were cited on old insurance maps as female boarding, a euphemism for prostitution. Omachi says some of these women worked to pay off their passages to America, while others were tricked into coming and spent years living and working in the shadows.
Those rooms maybe had space for a twin bed, a little table, maybe a chair. If you turn off the lights and just sort of imagine what it'd be like to be working here. Basically 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There would be lights, there would be candles, but it would be this feeling of isolation.
Karana Hattersley-Drayton, Fresno's historic preservation officer, has heard stories of people that used to disappear down here for days at a time.
So it does seem that there's a lot of evidence for a whole underground world. Whether these are just basements with some interesting features, whether there's actual freestanding tunnels and rooms, that's what we're still trying to prove or disprove.
City archaeologists used ground-penetrating radar and some shallow digging to see if there's more empty space down there. They're still working on the official report of their findings. Until then, one can only speculate whether the sealed brick archways are keeping any secrets. You can explore images from the search for Fresno's underground Chinatown. Just visit our website, californiareport.org. And there you have it, our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer with additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are June Stinson and Ali Tabatabai. Our Fresno intern is Leanne Lucetta. Karina Portillo produced our postcard from Fresno's Chinatown. Victoria Malione is our producer. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer. Kat Snow edited our climate change series. Bruce Kuhn is the news director. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California, and the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.